On This Week in Enterprise Tech, municipal fiber cometh, security needs extraordinary measures, and VMware is here to explain why a Type 2 hypervisor is your next big thing. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 265, recorded November 10th, 2017, Type 2 Hypervisors with VMware. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show that's dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise, but I can't guide you by myself. It's an awfully big world. I'm going to need a little help from my friends, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii, although today he seems to be home. Brian, what's going on?
Hey, man, it's Veterans Day, time to honor those that have given their ultimate sacrifice so that we can have our freedoms.
I get that. That's cool. And so you're doing that from home, and I get that. That's all right. I wish I probably should have thought of that. Also, someone who honors our freedoms is Mr. Lou Maresca. He's a bigwig over at Microsoft. He's been with the show for quite a while, and I'm so happy to have him because he keeps us abreast of all things Microsoft. Lou, how are you today, my friend?
Doing great, doing great. A little bit of sun here. It's a little bit of out of the ordinary, but we're doing great.
All right. Well, gentlemen, this is going to be one heck of a show. Not only are we going to be doing our blips and our bytes, but we're going to be bringing in someone from VMware. If you've wanted to decode the enigma that is the VMware black box, you're going to want to stay tabbed. But first of all, let's go ahead and kick it off with the blips. Now, on this very show, we have urged you, our listeners, our audience, to consider the benefits of publicly owned networks. After dozens of guests, stories, and ranting sessions, it seems as if the people, or at least a large group of them, have spoken, and they're ready to toss the incumbents to the curb in favor of municipal fiber. Almost 20 cities in Colorado, including Vail and Louisville, voted to join almost 100 other cities in the state to build their own networks. These cities have now become part of more than 200 across the country who have deployed or are planning on deploying city-owned broadband. By a majority running between 61 to 90% of the vote, these Colorado communities see the vote not as just a desire for faster connectivity, but as a mandate against Comcast and CenturyLink, who have consistently under-delivered on their promises. Of note is the fact that in 2005, the incumbents campaigned heavily for Colorado Senate Bill 152, which, when passed, restricted local governments from building their own networks. In 2017, with several major legal precedents having been set and incumbent trust at an all-time low, perhaps now is the time for all good men and women to demand real competition in the broadband space.
You remember Vault 7, right? Well, Vault 7 is that set of leaked tools, source code, and strategies from the CIA that used to infiltrate computers and smartphones. WikiLeaks ran this Vault 8 data leak, and it was back in between, I'm sorry, Vault 7 data leak back campaign back between March 23rd and 27th of September. Well, Vault 8 is a fresh batch of data and docs from the CIA in order to help investigative journalists, forensic experts, and the general public to better understand the agency's hacking tools. The first installment of Vault 8 describes a new back-end malware tool called Hive, where WikiLeaks has both source code and development logs. Hive proves as a covert communications platform for a barrage of CIA malware so that it can exfiltrate info to the CIA servers and receive updates with little to no detection. According to WikiLeaks, the CIA uses the Hive malware system to build fake web certificates and stop anti antivirus companies from accurately attributing its hacking operations. In fact, remember Kaspersky Labs? Well, this documentation shows that CIA was able to impersonate Kaspersky Labs, including source code, to fake a certificate from them assigned by Thwart Premium Server in Cape Town. There was also an immediate response from Kaspersky founder Eugene Kaspersky, who tweeted that the company could confirm that the certificates issued are not were basically fake. Hive looks like it's just the beginning to holiday season of hacking tools. So happy holidays.
Well, you might want to put off that visit to Delhi as air pollution reaches gas chamber levels. Well, we all saw how bad the air pollution was during the Olympics in Beijing, but now India's Delhi has reached levels 25 times that suggested by the WHO. At 640 micrograms per cubic meter, the combination of calm winds, seasonal crop burns, and unending vehicle emissions, Delhi's chief minister has been tweeting that the air in Delhi is now a gas chamber, with even the president of the Indian Medical Association calling it a public health emergency. If ever there was a need for worldwide action for the control of toxic emissions from industries and vehicles, it's now. We already know controls work since I lived through stage 3 smog alerts in the 70s while in Los Angeles. The air then and now are night and day. Makes me glad India is looking very hard at banning internal combustion engines in the future.
Now, with the continual improvement of deep neural networking and learning machines, there's a lot of speculation as to which human labor industries will be most affected by the coming wave of proto-AI. But for business process outsourcing firms, or BPO, the fear isn't just a speculative future date. It's already on the calendar. BPO firms in the Philippines, which just recently passed India as the call center capital of the world, have been able to outgrow the rivals because of the native population's use of English as a primary language. The PI now employs more than 1.15 million workers, and the sector is one of the top two earners of foreign currency that is vital to their economy. But even with crude AI, basically context-aware speech-to-text software, that advantage may not be a selling point in the near future. The IT and Business Process Association of the Philippines has estimated that pattern recognition AI will replace 40,000 to 50,000 jobs in the next 5 years, with that number rapidly increasing as AI develops. With the Philippine BPO industry taking in a 12.6% share of the estimated $250 billion outsourcing pie, there is now a mad dash to prove that their outsourcing is more than an easily replaced English translator bot.
So Google is clearly interested in reigniting their business in China. If you remember, Google pulled out its search engine and many other services from China back in 2010 due to government censorship. Why wouldn't Google explore new ways to pass to enter that mainland again? Well, even in reactivating its mobile store, it wasn't successful. China has become the biggest market for smartphones running Google Android software, but without Google services. Google's latest China strategy is a grassroots effort focused on the getting developers in the country trained and hooked on its AI building blocks. This strategy is used by many startups to increase adoption in the hard IT markets. Once the tools become popular, companies often accept the technology and sign up for the full services. Google is actively promoting TensorFlow software that makes it easier to build AI systems as a way to forge business ties in China. The Chinese government has made AI a national priority, making it a good place to start for Google. There's a good set of Chinese companies deploying machine learning systems, especially AI software that automatically adjusts to data. Some examples are AI that adjusts updates for bank services, identify face in crowds, and control drones. Even if Google's cloud business was allowed to put servers in mainland China, local rivals like Alibaba now sell cheap cloud computing products that would make it hard for the U.S. company to turn profit. This is Google's chance to get in on the ground floor, and they weren't going to take no for an answer anymore.
Senator Al Franken is pushing for net neutrality rules to apply to giant sites like Facebook and Google. Senator Franken's statement is, "As tech giants become a new kind of internet gatekeeper, I believe the same basic principles of net neutrality should apply here. No one company should have the power to pick and choose which content reaches consumers and which doesn't," Franken wrote yesterday in an opt-ed for The Guardian. Facebook, Google, and Amazon, like ISPs, should be neutral in their treatment of the flow of lawful information and commerce on their platforms. About 75% of internet news traffic referrals are handled by Google and Facebook, meaning that 3 out of 4 times an internet user accesses a news story online, they get it there via Google or Facebook. Facebook, Google, and Amazon have used their algorithms to extract unfair terms and fees from those dependent on its platform, promote their own products and services above those of competing companies, and even manipulate the emotional state of its users, he wrote. Franken was referring to a 2014 experiment conducted by Facebook. These companies don't operate in a rule-free zone, as they can face antitrust enforcement and Federal Trade Commission punishment for unfair trade practices. But by calling for a new form of net neutrality rules, Franken is clearly arguing that companies need to face a new, stricter type of regulation. Well, Franken didn't propose specific rules, but said Congress could conduct investigations and hold hearings to fully understand current practices and potential for harm. In my mind, this statement really illustrates just how disconnected Ajit Pai, you like how I brought that back to the FCC? Ajit Pai isn't listening to congressional overlords. And, you know, he's just trying to eviscerate the Wheeler net neutrality gains. And, you know, listen to your congressional overlords, dude.
Now, this past week, Marissa Mayer, former CEO of Yahoo, was forced to testify before a Senate panel about 3.5 billion user records that were exposed in breaches between 2013 and 2014. While this was embarrassing for the former CEO, especially since the breaches resulted in Yahoo shareholders losing out on hundreds of millions of dollars of value from the sale of Yahoo to Verizon, and the hearing had her on the defensive, observers weren't ready for Meyer's claim that only, quote, extreme measures, unquote, could stop the breaches going forward. Unfortunately, this has become the new rallying cry from C-suite executives from companies ranging from Sony to Equifax to Yahoo. The idea that they've done everything possible under the law and that only by granting enterprises more power or perhaps by turning a blind eye to their practices will the breaches stop. To their credit, the Senate panel was not satisfied with that motto, neither from Mayer, or from any of the other CEOs at the hearing. After the hearing, several staffers shared their amusement that the CEOs were demanding extraordinary measures when each of their networks had been breached by things as mundane as servers that weren't upgraded, default credentials that weren't changed, and USB drives that walked off the premise. In other words, we're not buying it. That does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bite. It's one going to be one that is will be driven by Chibit, but before we get there, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you a question. Did you enjoy your last mortgage experience? I mean, what isn't there to enjoy? To go to some complete rando at a bank, to drag banker's boxes filled with receipts, to beg and plead and try to convince that person that you really are worth the investment. I mean, that's enjoyable, right? That's something that we would all do as a pleasurable leisure activity. Of course not. It's horrible. That experience ranks as one of the most frustrating, one of the most stress-filled moments of our lives. Now, what if there was a company that could take that all away? What if there was a company that understood that the mortgage process needs to be brought into the modern era? Well, there is, and it's called Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Now, the mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence that you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Not some cookie cutter deal, but something that fits your life, that fits your needs, that fits your home. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at a touch of a button. It's all digital. No more receipts, no more old pay stubs, no more boxes of pieces of paper that you've been holding on to for years. Now, it's also powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And then based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and then help you to pick the one that's just right for you. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's go ahead and jump into the bites. And this one, well, it's I got a plea from one of my co-hosts who said, this is kind of close to me. This is something that I care about. So, Chibert, I'm going to call over to you Executive Order 12999, which I think is the order that tells us all to kill the Jedi. What is this?
And basically, this is from the Clinton administration. And it's basically called Call for Donation of Computers to Education. I just went through a horror story of a federal agency saying, oh, we can't, you know, even though we're going to have to throw the computer equipment away, we can't give it to you. And I said, wait, what? Huh? So I went and did some digging. I remember this executive order from when I was still serving. And let me just read some of it for you. In order to ensure that American children have the skills they need to succeed in the information-intensive 21st century, the federal government is committed to working with the private sector to promote four major developments in American education: making modern computer technology an integral part of every classroom, providing teachers with the professional development they need to use new technologies effectively, connecting classrooms to the national information infrastructure, and encouraging the creation of excellent educational software. This executive order streamlines the transfer of excess and surplus federal computer equipment to our nation's classrooms and encourages federal employees to volunteer their time and expertise to assist teachers and to connect classrooms. I have actually personally been involved with this, and our Kansas City office of the General Services Administration actually scheduled an upgrade with another federal agency. As we were doing the upgrades, the GSA employees went and refurbished the computers, wiped the hard drives, put fresh operating systems on them, and helped build a computer network for an inner city school in Kansas. So what I'm trying to do is say, hey, there's dwindling budgets everywhere. The federal government has made it easy. In fact, if you look at the paperwork necessary to do a disposal, say through DRML, if you're military, to properly dispose of the computing equipment, it's something like four or five sets of forms that you have to fill out. Whereas donating it to an educational institution is really only one set of forms. And especially if you're on the federal inventory management system, it's literally just click, 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 and fill out a form. It's not hard. And the executive order does go and say, hey, you know, don't give them junk. You know, give them something decent. In fact, a similar executive order that has since expired actually had a special type of deduction allowable for computer equipment for corporations, private corporations, to make donations to K through 12 educational institutions. Basically allowed you to have minimum two-year-old equipment, depreciate the first year normally. In the second year, you're allowed to do the accelerated depreciation if and only if you gave that to a K through 12 educational institution. Sadly, that deduction, I think, has gone away. I'm still trying to find it. I've been trying to twist Denise Howell's arm to try and get some help finding that in the tax laws, but sadly, she's not a tax lawyer. But the idea is the federal government has made a big step towards trying to make computing equipment, and it's actually going beyond that. It's actually scientific equipment. So that's how some of the federal the Navy is transferring some of their research vessels to educational institutions. So I'd like to put out a call to all the TWIT listeners. You know, this is not necessarily a U.S.-only effect. I've been hearing about the need for computer equipment in education all across the world. I've gotten lots of feedback from TWIT listeners saying, how the heck did I get that donation? And I've been leveraging Executive Order 12999 quite extensively. And our friends at the National Weather Service has decided this is the best thing since sliced bread. And it has been letting me have some very advanced workstations for teaching. So I'd like to put out a call that corporations and federal agencies consider contacting some of the local schools. Contact the whatever the computer instructor is, or the IT person for the school, or the headmaster or principal, and see if you can help. You know, schedule that upgrade. Instead of paying for the e-cycling to get rid of the old computers when you do upgrades, consider making the donation a little sooner. You know, take your deductions. And while the equipment is still usable for education, make the donation and schedule it so that when you do the upgrade, have it trucked on over to a school that probably needs it. Because I've been teaching in some fairly decent schools, and it's really, really common to see computer labs 10 years plus. You know, I've seen some computer labs at some of the schools here in Honolulu that are still running Windows XP or Windows 7 when they really should be running something a little more modern to prepare our children for the information age. So, Padre, Lou, you know, guys, I'm sure St. Ignatius would love some new machines, and I've heard of all kinds of programs at Microsoft to do this. Have you guys?
Well, that's the thing. We actually have partnerships with enterprises mostly. There's a lot of enterprises out there that are willing to donate to schools. We haven't really done anything with the federal government just because, I'm going to be honest with you, a lot of the equipment that we would get from a federal program is not going to meet the needs of our students or the needs of our campus. A lot of it is too old. A lot of it runs operating systems that we no longer support. Or a lot of it is just kind of, well, as you mentioned, they strip hard drives out of these things. So it would take more work than they are worth, at least from the perspective of my side. Lou, you've got the other side. You've got the enterprise side. And I know that Microsoft gives a lot to education. And one of the points that Chiba was trying to make before the show was, why couldn't there be a partnership here? This seems to be an awful lot of wasted material, both software and hardware, both from the federal side and the enterprise side. Why can't they work together?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's interesting. There's like a couple parallel orders kind of going on here, and I'm not sure why this one hasn't been brought up more. There's this other one that's, you know, around the STEM and computer science education that's in parallel to this one that was brought up by the current office. And again, they're asking for $200 million per year to be expanded towards computer education, K through 12 and higher education. And this particular program, there's over $300 million, it looks like, in the industry that's being actually donated by other industries. So I think Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Salesforce are all giving $50 million for that one. And Lockheed Martin's giving $25 million, and Accenture and GM, Pluralsight, are doing $10 million there. But that one's more around promoting just STEM and computer science and computer learning. Now, whether that money can be used for hardware, I don't know. That'd be interesting to find out. But it sounds like, you know, somebody needs to get together and merge these initiatives together so that more hardware can get out there for this type of education.
Chibert, you know, the more compelling part of this story is the fact that you could get equipment, non-computer equipment, scientific equipment. That does sound interesting because, of course, the federal government has access to a lot nicer toys than even the education sector. Is that under the same order, or is that a different request that you have to make?
No, actually, it's under the same order. So, like, for instance, I mentioned we got ships from the Navy. But I've heard of other places getting things like electron microscopes, gas chromatographs, things like that. Oscilloscopes, frequency analyzers. There's a lot of equipment that the federal government uses that they really ought to update more often, and they have the budget to do it, but they don't want to go through the pain of the disposal process. So what this executive order does for the federal agencies is it makes it politically correct to plan for the upgrades with the intent of being able to benefit education. Thank you, President Clinton. You know, it's not necessarily what he'll be remembered for, but It's a good executive order.
You know, it's interesting because we actually, the schools that my order runs in the Bay Area, we do have agreements with some major enterprises in the Bay Area where we essentially get every year a huge consignment of very nice networking gear. And it's not obsolete. It's not 10 years old. It's typically 2 to 3 years old because at that point it goes off of its service contract. And in a large enterprise, they're never going to keep that. They're not going to keep a switch in a colo that will no longer be serviced by Cisco or Juniper or whoever they bought it from. So we get a very nice box that's no longer under a service contract, but we've got our own IT guys to take care of it. And that works out really well. That's the kind of synergy between the enterprise and education that I like. And that's why I like dealing with enterprises, because it's clockwork. I know they're always going to be replacing something that we will need. I don't see that with the federal government. Chibert, you said that some of these boxes are going to be pretty old, right? I mean, by the time they're ready to donate, because they don't have that life cycle management like I do in even a small to medium enterprise.
Well, actually, quite a few federal agencies do have life cycle management. The stuff that I'm getting from the National Weather Service are on a 3-year cycle. And basically, when they're off the extended maintenance, that's when they start thinking about rolling them out, because they actually have done the numbers and the cost of the labor to maintain them after that isn't worth it. So I'm getting, you know, 3, max 4-year-old servers, switches, routers, and things like that that are worth my time. And so very similar to what your order's getting. I just wish more federal agencies would do this. There's a lot of misinformation going around within the federal agencies, and very, very, very few of them know about this executive order that they could utilize, and they could use that as justification on why they want to roll equipment out before it starts getting expensive to maintain.
Well, gentlemen, we could stay on this topic for a while, but I do want to get to our guest. I want to make sure he gets all the time that he deserves. But before we move, Chibert, this is Veterans Day, and you are home celebrating Veterans Day. And you have worked with quite a few men and women in the uniform. You did want to do one thing to honor our servicemen and women.
Yes, this is a video tribute. It dates back to 2015, but I found it. It's nice and short, and it is one of my favorite poems ever, and that is the poem of Flanders Field. So if you could play that.
In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders Fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you, from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep. Though poppies grow in Flanders Fields.
So to all the men and women in uniform, and all the men and women that maybe aren't in uniform but have served our country or our countries or the world, I say thank you very much on this Veterans Day.
Thank you, Chibert. And now comes my favorite time of every episode, and that's when we bring in our guest who is willing to share his or her knowledge with the Twilight Riot. And so we welcome to the show Mr. Michael Roy. He is the Product Line Marketing Manager at VMware. Michael, thank you very much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Oh, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. Been such a fan of the TWiT network for, God, years.
Yeah,
so,
indeed.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I love having you here because, of course, we've had VMware on the show before, and I think most of our audience is pretty well versed in what VMware does and the products that you offer. Or are they? I mean, VMware, from an old IT guy, is, I remember it as, oh, that was the first time I got real virtualization. That was the first time I actually got to start playing with things like, well, spinning up an entire cluster of boxes and then spinning them down when I don't need them. It was really the precursor to everything we have in the cloud today, especially container-based applications. But VMware has really kind of, well, I'd say evolved over the last couple of years. What have you seen from inside the walls as VMware has transitioned from flat a virtualization company to really sort of a productive infrastructure company?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So it's been a journey. I mean, we've been on this journey since 2001 or 2000 when we released, you know, VMware 1.0, which is what is now Workstation. So what we've seen is, you know, the containerization kind of getting smaller and smaller, moving towards the application as opposed to the infrastructure. And even at the same time on the infrastructure side, we're seeing that becoming sort of containerized as well. So the trends that I'm seeing are things like being able to operate at scale using scripting and you know, product agnostic type of stuff. The whole open source movement that's kind of moving in this direction is something that's very exciting. So when we can kind of maintain compatibility with that and adopt those new trends and those new patterns of behaving, and that's where we really add value for our customers. So, you know, being able to, for example, throw containers directly onto ESX without having to have a host actually running, like a Docker host running. So that type of stuff, being able to manage all that through Kubernetes and being able to, and then on the other side of the house through end user computing, deliver desktops through all of that same similar technology. So it's been an amazing journey to watch it grow from, you know, the abstraction layer one all the way to abstraction right down to the application itself.
Yeah, no, that has been a lot of fun because actually Cheebert and I were sitting in multiple interops over the course of 15 years. And we actually saw that because we went from literally six or seven racks, 42U racks of nothing but those 1U HP pizza boxes. And we would have to, you know, bring one of those up every single time we wanted to start a new service or every time we wanted distributed load across multiple servers. And then one year we walked into the warehouse and it disappeared and we had two 42U racks and it said VMware on it. And they started training us on how to use them. And it was one of these sort of eye-opening experiences of, wait, what did you just do? How do I bring it? I can bring up a brand new desktop. So is that sort of aha moment. I think for engineers who were used to just having to plug in new boxes every time they wanted a new capability, that was something else. But let's get past the nostalgia because you're here specifically to talk about a VMware product that you think our audience might enjoy using, and that's Fusion. Can you tell me what is Fusion? Of course, people probably know, but give me the layman's explanation.
Yeah, sure. In the simplest of terms, it's a simple way to run Windows on your Mac. Back in the day, you know, around 2004, 2005, I was running a data center in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, in Canadian. And I had a great time. And the problem that I had was, you know, the machine that they gave me was a Windows machine. So being able to use, interoperate that with what was going on in the network, everything was open source, all Linux, Unix, BSD, stuff like that. It was a pain. So I got a Mac as soon as they switched over to Intel because it was POSIX under the hood. But then I was left without having Windows. So for me, it was really important to be able to use a couple of tools that I still needed and running those on my Mac while maintaining the compatibility that I had with, you know, everybody else I was working with. But now, you know, it's kind of forked in sort of two directions. One is that I'm a simplified use case where I'm trying to run Windows on the Mac. I have a, you know, legacy application, maybe it's QuickBooks, Quicken, something like that. And I'm a home user and I'm sort of, you know, maintaining that application and while on this new machine that I've got. But we've also sort of seen the adoption and the growth happening around our professional users in our enterprise sector, where we've been delivering features for IT pros and developers to kind of help the builders sort of build things as well as making the, you know, just I need that one application on the Mac very simple. So at its core, it runs Windows on the Mac, but it's so much more powerful than that because it allows you to run any operating system on the Mac. It's the compatible with the vSphere infrastructure. It's the same as Workstation, basically. So it allows you to run anything from the VMware infrastructure on that machine and then transfer that to any other objects within the VMware infrastructure. So, it really stretches that end-to-end, the consumer all the way to the enterprise sort of a use case.
There are a lot of people who think of Fusion as just a thing that allows them to run Windows on their Mac. But as you just explained, there's many more components to that. That whole running Windows on a OS X machine is just table stakes. What are the other efficiencies that I can gain by running Windows applications through Fusion?
Yeah, so at a high level, it really allows you to reduce the number of machines you have to carry around, right? So you don't have to carry a Windows machine and a Mac around if you're doing corporate stuff. But on the other side of the table, for example, if you're a developer and you're doing quality, you know, you can automate the deployment of your applications through virtual machines. So basically, you can tell Fusion to kick off a VM and then run all of your testing within it. And then if everything passes, then you can promote that virtual machine over to vSphere. And then from there, you know, scale it out as you need within the enterprise. Or if you're using like, you know, Docker and container type things, you can prototype it on the local machine and then push that up to the cloud. And run that, whether it's in AWS or anywhere else, you know, that's the kind of the one of the magic things about Docker is with Fusion this year, we actually built in our Docker host, which is called Photon. And the Photon operating system is the VMware compatible way to essentially run containers and Docker images and things like that. So by having that running on the local machine and then being able to push into the cloud, it really kind of gives you that seamless, you know, that same experience or that same, you know, it really avoids the problem of it worked on my laptop because of that compatibility and that transferability of whether it's the virtual machine itself or it's a Docker container where the application is containerized. So not only does it allow you to do things more quickly, but it allows you to do them more reliably because you're automating these things, right? So that automation allows a sense of reliability that you're always going to do the same thing over and over again. So for quality assurance and testing, it really allows them to kind of meet that end-to-end use case. But for like an IT guy who's like more of a jack-of-all-trades sort of pro, it allows them to run web servers and other applications on a local machine. And then whether that's like a static machine that you're running them as servers or if they're transient and you're testing them and whatnot, it really services basically as that it doesn't matter what tool you're trying to run. You can run those on your Mac. And whether that's in the cloud, a server, or a desktop application, it gives you that versatility.
This year I went to VMworld in Las Vegas for just one day. I could only make it down. I spent most of my time in the press room talking to a couple of people, doing a few interviews. And then when I got home, someone told me, oh, wait, you didn't pick up the VMworld box? I missed what was in the VMworld box? Because everyone kept telling me that I missed out.
You missed the box. I will be sure to get one sent over to you. I've got one right here.
Me too.
Oh, man.
So what we did was it's our 10th anniversary. We released the Fusion originally in 2007, and you only have a 10th anniversary once. So we stopped putting them in boxes a bunch of years ago. I think it was around VMware 5 was the last one we did. It's retail is just there's no point to it these days. Everything is electronically delivered, and you know, buying something on a physical thing, it's out of date by the time you install it. So it logistically, we just got rid of it and moved on. But it's really nice to have that thing if you're a developer that you've built and that you've worked on to say like, hey, this is a thing that I did. I was there at this moment in time and we worked on this thing and here it is, right? So that was really kind of an effort to really give our developers something that they could sort of put on their desk. So what it is, it's a little tin and within it is a lovely collectible coaster there. On Fusion on the one side, it's got Workstation on the other side, and then a USB stick that came with pre-release versions of Fusion 10 and Workstation 14 at the time. So basically, we were selling it for $100, and you would get three licenses, a Fusion and a Workstation for Linux and a Workstation for Windows license. We went through VMworld, so if you know, we ran out of that. However, behind a closet somewhere in the nethers of our storage, we did find another box or two. So we were able to put them online. So if you go over to VMwareMerchandise.com, there's a tech section there. You can get this for $160, which is the regular price of a Fusion license. And it comes with Fusion 10 and two licenses for Workstation 14. And we'll send you the nice little collectible box that you can put on your desk.
Now, this included the Fusion Pro. What have you added to make it Pro?
Sure. So Fusion Pro really enhanced around the IT developer sort of a use case. And originally, the first sort of features that we put into it were around being able to configure networking. So the virtual networking stack within the Fusion environment itself, you can have an interface now to configure to be able to create new networks and configure their you know, some of the basic parameters. This year, we've improved on that, whereby we've actually added the ability to configure NAT, so all of your port forwarding rules. As well as a really interesting feature just for pro users around network simulation. So what we can actually do is we can simulate a degraded network. So if you have an application that you want to test how resilient it's going to be in a packet loss sort of a situation, you can, on the virtual network layer, actually introduce packet loss and then introduce latency as well as a bandwidth cap. And that will allow you to really both on inbound and outbound. And that allows you to test kind of some of the application's resiliency. We added a few other features this year as well. Most notably for the pro users is the API. We added a RESTful API. Basically, it's an HTTP server that delivers what's called a Swagger-based JSON output RESTful UI. And it's great because it allows you to what I was mentioning earlier. It allows like a standardized way for automating and integrating it with like a DevOps sort of a pipeline. So these are use cases that professionals sort of rely on in the development space. On the IT pro space, we also added in the case of a vSphere administrator, we have a lot of integration there. So Fusion Pro has been where we add those features, and this year we added the ability to control hosts. So now you can take and connect to an ESX host or to a vCenter server. Take a host and put that into maintenance mode or power it off or power it on, or I should say restart it, not power it on, DRAC or something for that. But it's really focused around whether it's a developer. There's a few things we built there. And for the IT pro, it's really all about integrating with vSphere.
Every once in a while, I'll get an email from someone who he started in IT and he's trying to explain to an executive why he wants to virtualize, why he wants to use a product like Fusion, specifically why he wants to use a hypervisor. And he always has difficulty explaining it in a way that the executive will actually understand. So what would be your elevator pitch to a executive with some technical knowledge who would just say, wait a minute, why go through the extra complexity of a hypervisor? Why not just dual boot? Why not just have multiple installs that I can bring up when that particular set of tools is necessary? What do I get from VMware's hypervisor?
Sure. And that kind of gets answered on a couple of different levels. So for example, if I'm a business, what could motivate me in this case is having control over the operating system that they're using. So as a corporate entity, we can create the standard operating system that would get deployed, whether it's to a physical computer or to a virtual machine, and distribute that to all of our users using, whether it's using Fusion or Workstation or Player. So regardless of what hardware you've got, you can share the same base image or the same operating system image that the corporate, compliance requirements sort of demand. And if you're like a developer, what it allows you to do is reduce the amount of hardware that you need to buy and allow you to get it more versatile. So you can do basically more with less. And it really depends on, like I said, what that use case is. But for businesses, it's all about having control. And for developers, it's all about having versatility. And for IT pros, it's about having that compatibility.
All right, let's go into that versatility and that compatibility. Because one of the main advantages for me to use Fusion is this idea of prototyping, fast prototyping. I can mess around, screw something up, dump it, reload a package, and just keep going. What, in your mind, are the main advantages of how VMware handles prototyping versus what I would do with Docker or a lighter hypervisor-based solution?
Sure. Because, we've been doing this for some time. We've been able to add a lot of extra features in addition to just the hypervisor hooks into the CPU to run, an operating system inside of another one. So, for example, you would have the ability to take snapshots, is a really important one because we can kind of pause the computer at a point in time and then always revert back to that. So you can create a gold template master, so to speak, or a known good configuration. And then, like you said, go in, play down, get into the dark ends of the forest, and then realize that, you've been eaten by a Gru. Suddenly you hit the reset button and you're back where you started at the beginning of your adventure. So it really allows you to have that control. And it's granular, too, because you can fork all of those. So you can have snapshots of snapshots of snapshots. So you can have a whole variety of different systems all within one main computer, or I should say within one virtual machine package. Or if, for example, you want to have portability, you can actually clone those virtual machines. So whether you're a developer and you're creating a server template, or you're an IT administrator and you've got your desktop template, you can clone those and it'll do all the right things in terms of applying new MAC address and requesting new DHCP leases and new UUIDs and things like that inside of the sysprep and any other guest customization stuff that you would do. But it allows you to basically stamp out those templates and then quickly, easily distribute them. So it really just, like I said, it allows you to get that versatility to maintain all that compatibility across the board, whether you're, developing stuff or you're deploying actual pre-built desktop applications.
We've got JJ to the 4884 in our chat room who is wondering about using snapshots for things like Linux distros. And I was just kind of smiling because that's actually one of the things that I really enjoy, the fact that I don't just have to say, okay, I'm going to make the perfect image and then that's my snapshot or that's my image and that's what I go back to. I can literally just say, okay, I made a change. Let's take another snapshot. Let's take another snapshot. And I can have them all ready to spin up at a moment's notice. When you start doing that, I think you very quickly realize that you don't want to go back to the old way of saying, oh, shoot, well, I have to restore back to an image that's 6 months old, and now I have to bring it up to date. It works so much better. Now, we did have a question from Rorks in the chat room who wanted to know, and I think this is more philosophical than it is technical, why VMware would insist on its own proprietary hypervisor rather than using, say, the hypervisor that OS X provides or that Microsoft provides.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think it comes back down to like basically how we build our personal desktop line of products, which is Fusion, Workstation, and Player. Every year, we take a derivative of vSphere. So we take a fork, we put a line in the sand, we fork vSphere, and we turn that into our Type 2. So we go from the Type 1 hypervisor and we port it and turn it into the Type 2. So we're very much beholden to all of the features and capabilities that go into that engine and that development chain. So porting that to another hypervisor is a non-trivial activity, I would say at the beginning. So if you have so many dollars to spend as a development manager, you know, the question is where are you going to add value, right? So you have $10, if porting to other hypervisors is like a $100 feature. So it's not something that's trivial. So it's something that we're looking at because we all want to maintain, we want to stay nimble and agile and whatnot. But our value is because we've been iterating on this hypervisor for so long, we've added features that we depend on. You know, it's like the consumerization of IT, for example. Everybody's so used to iPhones and how rapid this technology works and how simple it's become that, you know, the complexity, like you were talking earlier, of deploying a physical rack, and now it's like click vCenter, click clone, done. It's so much, there's a new expectation that's been set. So because we sort of have that, we rely on the technologies that we've built into the hypervisor, and they're very special to us. So porting those over would be a challenge, and B, we're happy to innovate in other ways that bring value as opposed to just, the user basically doesn't really care what the underpinning is as long as it's going to work, I would say, whether it's compatibility or performance or whatnot. So I think it's about where we're spending our development dollars.
Okay, now that's the feature answer for that question. But I think the more VMware-centric answer to the question is that ultimately, I think your marketing people would agree with this, is you want someone to be so impressed with the capabilities of Fusion, with the fast prototyping and with Snap packages, that eventually they move up to a Type 1 hypervisor. That's a natural upgrade path that we wouldn't have if we were using Apple or Microsoft's hypervisor.
Right. There's no virtual box for the data center. All right. So it's a whole other kind of conversation. But because we have that portability and that compatibility, we can have that sort of better together, end to end from the desktop to the data center sort of story. The way I look at Workstation and Fusion, it's like it's running the whole data center in your laptop, essentially, because data centers are all abstracted and virtualized. You are running all of that, just the layers above and beneath it in terms of the network and the virtualized hardware don't matter anymore.
Right, right. Now, one last question before I bring my co-host back into discussion, and that is, I'm going to ask you to put on your prognosticator's hat here and say, what do you see for the future of virtualization in the Windows space, the OS X space, and in the Linux space coming up, say, near term, 5 years? In 5 years, what will this look like? Will we still have this hypervisor-heavy virtualization right alongside very lightweight containers? Is there going to be some sort of confluence of these technologies? What is VMware's strategy for that 5-year plan?
Yeah, I see it. I would look at it in twofold. I see virtualization becoming more of an application facilitator, where it is a delivery mechanism to deploy applications. From a compatibility perspective, it's going to work no matter what machine you put it on. I think on the other side of the house, there's a security story that's being told here. For example, Microsoft has some interesting technologies called VBS. If you guys haven't heard of it, I'm sure you have. Credential Guard and Device Guard. These are interesting technologies that leverage Hyper-V. And Fusion and Workstation actually both support this as a guest operating system this year. So you can run it. You can enable these features. It took a whole bunch of virtual hardware requirements to facilitate it, including leveraging new CPU features like extended page tables and stuff. But The point being is where I'm seeing is applications are becoming more and more virtualized, and they're leveraging virtualization technology to be dependent upon from a security perspective. So this VBS stuff, it basically traps calls to the kernel and validates whether or not those calls are allowed. So, you know, you're seeing virtualization being used in a security case there. On applications, I see it, you know, if you look at how simple it is to deploy a consistent application with Docker, I see that just becoming more and more translated to the desktop type of an application. There's no reason why you couldn't Dockerize an Xorg or Wayland-based Linux application. And as Microsoft is developing more or is adopting more and more POSIX standards, you're going to be able to see more ubiquitous applications between Mac, Windows, or at least Windows and Linux. So yeah, I would say it's on the app side of being able to deliver things, and it's on the security side to be able to have an extra layer in there. And then on top of all that, you have management, being able to deploy these things at scale and in swaths in an instant, and then destroy them just as quickly, is I think where things are going. Like applications nowadays, you don't even really need a server in a sense. You just need to be able to have the right runtime environment. So the rest of the stuff gets abstracted away. So you're seeing those trends going to continue to get smaller and into different areas of the technology.
Right. Right. I do want to bring my co-host back into the discussion. And Cheaper, let's start with you. I mean, you were really the man who sort of brought me into the world of virtualization. When that VMware cluster showed up, you were the one who explained exactly what it was, and then showed me the tools on how to spin images up and down. What would you want out of a future version of Fusion?
Well, I've got one of my wish lists has been around for a long time, and that's being able to go back and forth between ESX and Fusion. I actually had a power management project that has been wound down, and we don't want to have to pay for the hosting the virtual image anymore. But every once in a blue moon, I want to bring it up so I can show people. I actually run that on my Fusion on my laptop. But as far as runtimes and things like that, and on my wish list, I would love to be able to run ARM-based images. Specifically, I would love to be able to prototype Raspberry Pis on my Mac, but right now can't do it. What do you think, man? Are we going to see foreign chipsets someday?
Well, there's two ways I would answer that. One is, God, that would be so difficult because ARM doesn't have the same virtualization extensions that exist on the CPU instruction set that Intel has, and the x86, I should say. Two, Pat Gelsinger, who is our CEO, is known for kind of spearheading and shepherding the x86 iron out of Intel back in the day. He was one of the original product managers of that. That being said, I'm not going to say that there isn't maybe a super secret skunk work project on virtualizing ARM, but I'm not going to say that there is either.
That's actually a project I'd like to see too. Now, we do have a couple of people who are starting to chomp at the bit in the chat room. They really like their questions answered. We've got Tex in San Diego, who is wondering why his VMs run so slow in his VM box. He's wondering if multiple hypervisors might be competing with each other, and I've tried to assure him that they really shouldn't be. But how does Fusion and how does VMware deal with the fact that there are now multiple hypervisors that will be operating within any instance?
Yeah, so performance is a tricky thing. So I've been with VMware since 2009, and when I first came to VMware, I worked at Apple for a little while. I was doing, it was tier two tech support there. So I actually started and ran the Fusion and Workstation support team at around version two. So I've had a lot of time troubleshooting this sort of thing. And it kind of comes down to a few components, right? You're splitting your resources between your Mac and your guest operating system. So you have to leave enough on the Mac so that the Mac can do its business. And you have to give enough to the guest so that it can do what it needs to do too. And there's a balancing act with that. And it really depends on what you're trying to do. Solid state drives made a huge difference. The old school platter drives, especially Macs that shipped with 5400 RPM drives, were terribly slow. But that got better and that got better. So I would say that you kind of want to look at a few things. So one, where is the bottleneck? Is it disk activity? You can use some tools to probe that. Is it CPU? Is the guest pegging? Is there some process in Windows that's doing something? Or is Windows showing zero and you see in Activity Monitor the VMX process using 100% CPU or more? That could indicate a bug, and I would say get in touch with support. But by and large, on modern hardware, the performance is pretty fantastic. But, there are always cases, and as hardware gets more and more complex too, where there's going to be weird things that happen that either we can really quickly fix or they're going to require us to fix the bug. And the best way to fix bugs with us is to get in touch with our support guys and gals. They're a great bunch of folks, and they can have direct relationship with our engineering team to file bugs and make sure we get things fixed.
Yeah. I will say that I know that the hypervisor in Windows 10, I'm not sure, or maybe just the server version, it does have a very good performance monitor, and it will tell you what you're running low on or what IO bus is being maxed out. And more times than not, it's memory. It's just the fact you don't have enough memory in your box and it's doing a lot of swapping. That's, for me, that's the number one killer to performance. We actually had another question, a good question from the chat room, from Plutonium Shore. And actually, this is a question that I have. This goes with that whole VMs living alongside containers. What is the differentiator there? For someone to explain again to that semi-tech literate executive why they're running both containers and VMwares on ESX, what would be your explanation?
It's a way to sort of manage the old world and the new, right? So operations teams really admire the compatibility that you have on an operating system, because at the end of the day, an operating system is still going to work the way that an operating system is going to work. Even though we've done cloud things where we've abstracted the heck out of it and distributed it all, when you're dealing with an operating system on metal and a virtualization layer in between, it's still going to behave this sort of the same way. So operations teams are very invested in the current infrastructure and how things work. So deploying, for example, if you wanted to do all containers on all native hardware, would require a different type of management and a different way of thinking about how to manage that actual infrastructure. So what I'm seeing is actually, you know, enterprises are deploying VMs as a way to run their Docker container images, because the template that the Docker host can run on then can be iterated and version controlled and checked. And then on the other side, it allows the IT operations teams to use the same tools that they're using today to manage the scale of the infrastructure while letting another application layer of management manage the actual Docker containers themselves. So something like Docker or Kubernetes, for example, managing the container hosts while the infrastructure is still the vSphere infrastructure. And those clusters that you're building, those resource pools that you're building, you're giving those to the Kubernetes master engine to deploy that as workloads. So to me, it's kind of the best of both worlds. You know, it's, if there are cases where you need like super high performance, we also have ways of tuning that. And that's becoming more and more of an interesting thing. You're seeing more big data type applications being run on VMware infrastructure. But I think it's all about, you know, the management that is why you would want to do both at the same time.
Right. And let's get real practical here. It also depends on what images you're trying to spin up, by the way. I know people who think that every VM should run the same because it's all virtualized. Not really. As you mentioned, if you're running a big data application, it's going to suck down a lot more resources than just spinning up a desktop. So just, you know, keep that in the back of your mind. VMs are fantastic, and I love having a bunch of them in my pocket. They are not magic. They do not tap into a new dimension of computing resources. Cheebert, back over to you. So one of the things that we have covered every time we've had VMware on is we've talked about the evolution of ESX and how it, it's gone from just its own hardware to now it plays well with others to now it's I can do hybrid deployments. What do you see as the next step? I mean, VMware had a few difficult years, but I think they're through that now and they're in back onto growth. For you, what's the future of VM?
I'd actually like to see maybe a little bit more, shall we say, more robust Linux support. JJ is actually asking and going, moving things around, getting things onto the Linux version of VMware is kind of painful. And I was kind of hoping that as time goes on, some of the Linux supports might get a little better. The other thing that I'm kind of wondering about, I have never tried it, but can I run virtual apps on Fusion? I've never tried that.
It depends on what you mean by a virtual app. There's a huge distinction
like Rails.
There. Like Ruby on Rails type of thing, you mean? Or
No. It's being able to virtualize an app, you know, like on it used to be called Rails under the RDP world, where instead of bringing an entire desktop out, it just brings the app window. I've never tried it. I don't see why it wouldn't work.
Yeah, we don't do that with Fusion. That's part of our Horizon play. So we have this this technology called App Blast and App Volumes that allows that sort of use case to happen where you have a client and then the application is just, it's like Unity mode. So we have this Unity mode in Fusion in a workstation where you've obfuscated or you've gotten rid of the desktop and you only have the application in front of you. So this technology, it's built on a protocol called Blast. And it's a part of our Horizon 7 suite, and it basically allows you to have that application in Unity mode running on the infrastructure in the data center, but just the application is what you see on the desktop.
Yeah, and why don't we go with the other half of the question and get back to what's like Lurker and JJ to the 4884 asking about any news on Linux support improvements? Like Lurker is saying it was a sad day when VMware GSX server for Linux was discontinued. Any comments?
Yeah, I remember that. It was tough. You could see the play where we were moving more towards ESX and vSphere and things like that at the time. So, we did update the Linux version this year for workstation in that case. We added GTK3 support and a couple of other features. I would say that Linux and workstation for me are going to be very high priority this next iteration, this next big release. So personally, I'm a POSIX guy, right? So I love Linux. I've been an open source guy like my whole life. So for me, it's near and dear to my heart. So I absolutely want to make sure that I continue to iterate that. From a development perspective, we almost prefer working on the Linux platform than we do the Windows platform just because of an ease of development. We can do a lot more with it, which is kind of, it comes back to that you have so many dollars, more users are spending it on Windows. It costs more time to make features on Windows. And it's this kind of priority back and forth, right? Because Linux represents a really tiny number of our user base. But I love it. It's near and dear to my heart, and I want to do more with it. So I would just kind of leave it at that.
Michael Roy, the product line marketing manager at VMware. Unfortunately, we are out of time, actually way over time. I do want to thank you for joining us. Could you leave our audience with some final words of wisdom? If they're looking into a new virtualization solution, or if maybe they just want to try out Fusion so they can see if they want to make the switch, what would you tell them? What bits of knowledge would you give them?
I would say, try it out. We have a free trial that's absolutely available. vmware.com/go/tryfusion. You can just go to VMware. There's a pretty easy way to find it on the menu on the left there. And it's 15-day free trial. We're certainly able to help you out on the community forums if you have any questions and things like that. And our support guys and gals are really fantastic to help new folks along too. So if you have any trouble when you do purchase it, we give you 18 months of email support and we'll give you a call and we can do like screen sharing and stuff if you get into trouble. It's an easy way to try it out to see, make sure it's going to work on your machine. It requires some sort of a newer Mac for the current version of this version 10 here, but yeah, it's easy to try. It's for free, both for workstation and for Fusion. So try it out.
Well, why don't I make this offer? When VMworld rolls around again, we're definitely going to have you back on as a guest, maybe right after the show happens, just so you can go over some of the newly released features. And if you have any sort of demo that shows how this is going to make Linux a little bit easier, I'm sure we have a couple members of our audience who would love that. Can I make that offer?
Absolutely. I would love to. That'd be great.
Again, Michael Roy is the product line marketing manager at VMware. We thank you for joining us here on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Folks, you've done it again. You have used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 containers. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry, VMs. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible. Of course, that means I need to talk about my co-hosts. These are the guys without whom I would not do this show because it just wouldn't be fun. You have to have fun in everything you do. And, that fun starts with Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, what are you up to? I know next week you might be a little bit late because you've got some fun stuff going on at Microsoft. And I understand there's some secret developments going on at Dynamics that you probably can't talk about, right?
Dynamics, I have no idea. I don't even know anybody in Dynamics anymore. No, I'm just kidding. but next week I'm actually traveling to the East Coast to see some family for the Thanksgiving week. So I'm going to spend some time doing that. But all my work, you could definitely find my work at dev.office.com. Check all that stuff out. Check all they do for added capabilities, the SSO capabilities, all that stuff. Check out there. And of course, you can find me on Twitter at Lumem.
Yeah, thank you very much. And also, our geek in paradise, Chibert. That's right, Brian Chi, who is currently home. Chibert, I'm assuming you're going to go back to the office at some point, hopefully not too soon. What's the weather like in Hawaii? I forgot to ask this in the morning because it got cold over here on the mainland.
Oh, it's so terrible. It's down into the 70s now.
I do not care for you right now. You are a bad man. Chibert, where can they find you?
I am ADVNETLAB at Twitter. And I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. I'd love to hear from you. We're actually pretty good. We're actually booked on shows all the way through into February now, which is kind of cool, which means I can relax a little bit on my vacation. Quiet, right? I'm sorry. I'm going to be off the air the month of December, but I'll be back in the new year. I've got a few more shows. I leave 1st of December. I'm going to go see what's left of the Caribbean.
Oh, I know. You had that booked a long time ago, right?
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. I've actually got a few friends that are still in Puerto Rico helping with the recovery, the ITDRC. They're providing communication support to try and bring up communications between hospitals and government centers. So might say hi to them if they're around. And, I'd love to hear from you. This and many other shows were driven by viewers of the Twilight Riot. And look for a schedule that's going to start filling up quickly. We've got several corporations that want to use a regular show. So we're going to start doing a regular booking with a couple of large corporations so we can hear things as they're happening much, much quicker.
Indeed. Chibert, thank you. Lou, thank you. Gentlemen, I salute you. And I also salute you, the people who come back week after week. We couldn't do this show without an audience, and you are one of the best and brightest audiences that we have here in the Twit Army. We want to make it a little easier for you to get the shows that you want. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you'll find all of our back episodes. You can download them in whatever format you want. And you'll also find our drop-down menu for subscribing. Folks, this is the best way to support the show. If you want us to keep going, if you want to keep getting all your enterprise goodness, you can choose to have a audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version downloaded into your device of choice automatically every week once they become available. This is also a really good link to share with your friends if you think they might want to jump into the Twilight Riot. Also, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo who have allowed us to continue doing this show, and to our TD who today is Josh the iPhone Birdman. Josh, let me ask you a question. Now that you have the iPhone 10, how long until you regret it?
Until I regret it? Not yet. Until next year, maybe.
Just watch his Twitter feed at the Mac and Josh, and you'll see exactly when that happens. Also, I keep forgetting to ask this. Folks, we have a best of episode coming up, and I want your input. Remember, I was gone for a large chunk of the year in silence, and I want to know what are your favorite moments from this year's programming of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We are putting together these best ofs with you in mind. So just go to twit.tv/best of. That's best of, B-E-S-T-O-F, and fill out the form with whatever information that you remember so that we can locate that particular moment, that particular event, and get it into your year-end enterprise goodness. Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.